Picture this. You're 19 years old. You've just been dropped into a city that sits directly on the Arctic Circle. It's 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and outside your window, it is pitch black.
I mean, not just twilight or a cloudy day.
No, I mean night. And you're expected to go out into that darkness in temperatures that can freeze your breath to your face and convince strangers to completely change their worldview. Oh, and you have to do it in a language that J.R. Tolkien reportedly used as the basis for Elvish because it was so.
So notoriously complex.
Exactly.
It's a scenario that sounds like an endurance test. You've got extreme environmental isolation, profound linguistic barriers, and, the crushing social pressure of being a missionary. It's a perfect storm for either a total breakdown or.
Or a massive breakthrough. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're unpacking a fascinating stack of documents titled Experiences 9. This is a collection of personal memoirs from American missionaries in Finland, mostly from the 1970s.
And I think we should be clear up front. Whether you're religious, spiritual, or just a student of human behavior, these stories are an incredible case study.
Absolutely. The mission of this deep dive isn't to preach theology. It's to explore how these young men navigated an environment that was hostile on almost every level, weather, culture, language, and how they found these moments of profound, almost inexplicable human connection.
It's the ultimate stranger in a strange land story.
It really is. And let's set the stage with the location, because the geography here is practically a character in the story. We're talking about Rovaniemi.
Rovaniemi is the capital of Lapland. It's quite literally the gateway to the Arctic. In the winter, you're dealing with a phenomenon called Kamos, the polar night.
Right.
Bruce Skalja, one of the writers in our source text, he describes arriving there in December. He says for 3 weeks, he didn't see even a slit of the sun. The sun just didn't rise above the horizon at all.
That does something to your brain. Just endless, heavy twilight.
If the sky was clear, Skalja mentions seeing the northern lights, which is beautiful, but otherwise it's just this heavy, oppressive darkness.
And then there's the cold.
Oh, the cold. We're not talking put on a light jacket cold. We have accounts here from Greg Colton, who was serving in Salo, which is actually further south, but still.
Still brutal.
Right. He was living in an apartment with absolutely no hot water.
I noted that part in the memoirs. He describes washing his hair in a freezing sink. He talks about sleeping in a sleeping bag with his back pressed against the wall just to stay warm enough to study.
And that physical discomfort just compounds the mental strain. Colton is very honest in his writing. He talks about sitting in discussions with local Finns and not understanding a single word.
He was physically in the room, but linguistically, he was completely locked out. That's a terrifying feeling to have a purpose you're desperate to communicate, but zero tools to do it.
And Finnish isn't like learning Spanish or French for an English speaker.
Not even close.
No. Finnish is a Uralic language. It has 15 noun cases. It doesn't behave like the Indo-European languages we're used to. So you have these young guys who feel like toddlers. Which actually leads us to one of the most ingenious adaptations I've read in these kinds of memoirs.
The Moo
The
program.
Moo
I
program.
love this. It sounds like some kind of government initiative, but
It's all.
it was basically a survival strategy.
It was brilliant social engineering. Paul Sharman details this. The new missionaries in Rovaniemi realized they couldn't learn the language just from textbooks. They needed conversation.
But who wants to talk to a struggling foreigner for hours?
Exactly. So they created a network of elderly women, moosis or grandmas, to practice on.
Now, on the surface, that sounds a little transactional. Let's use these grandmas for language practice.
It does, but look at the context. You have these young American men who are lonely, homesick, and desperate to communicate. And on the other side, you have these elderly Finnish women, many of them widows, who are socially isolated and lonely themselves.
So it became symbiotic.
Totally. The missionaries would visit to practice their lessons, but it evolved into something much deeper. Sharman lists them by name: Sister Kekkonen, Sister Tenhonen. These women weren't just tutors, they became surrogate grandmothers. They fed them, they listened to them, and in many cases, they ended up joining their church.
And this network of mutis, it actually sets up one of the most cinematic moments in the entire collection.
Oh, absolutely. If you're looking for a story that illustrates the strange magic of these interactions, it's the story of Ralph Valentine and the waiting at the door.
This scene is so vivid. Valentine and his companion, Vern Bowden, are out knocking on doors. Now, usually the standard procedure is you knock, you wait maybe 30 seconds, a minute.
And if nobody answers, you move on.
Yeah,
Efficiency, right?
right. But at this one door, for reasons they couldn't logically explain, they just They froze. They felt a strong intuition to wait.
Which, in the world of door-to-door proselyting, standing on a porch for several minutes is excruciatingly awkward.
I can't even imagine. But they stood there. And finally, the door opens.
And it's an 86-year-old woman, Sister Kumpula. She invites them in. They teach her a bit. But again, the language barrier is this elephant in the room. They realize they can't effectively communicate.
So they decide to come back, but this time with a translator.
And they describe this as a specific spiritual prompting. They decide to bring Sister Tenthon in.
One of the Mumis we just mentioned.
Exactly. They bring one grandma to meet another grandma. So imagine the scene. They walk into the house with Sister Tenthon in.
Yeah.
Bedlam. The two women scream. They embrace. It turns out they were best friends. They hadn't seen each other in 20 years. Life, distance, age. They lost touch.
That is incredible. Two best friends reunited because two teenagers decided to stand on a porch for 3 minutes instead of 30 seconds.
It gets even deeper. Sister Kumpula later told them that when they first knocked, she didn't answer right away because she was in her bedroom on her knees praying for true messengers to come to her home.
Wow.
She was 86, moving slowly, and had to get up from her prayer to answer the door. That's why it took so long.
So if they had left after the standard wait time.
That reunion never happens. The prayer goes unanswered in that moment. It really highlights this theme of tender mercies that runs through the text. These small, seemingly illogical decisions that have massive payoffs.
It gives you chills. It really does. But I want to pivot a bit because not every story is that heavy. There's a lot of humor in here too, mostly born out of awkwardness. And we can't talk about this deep dive without talking about Sister Kreutzer.
Sister Kreutzer is a recurring character in the Rovaniemi lore. She was a widow, lived in a small cottage, and apparently had a soft spot for the missionaries. Carrie Barney mentions they were warned, if you visit Sister Kreutzer, expect a big smackaroo on the cheek.
But the standout story with her involves a missionary named Daryl Dudley and the infamous tie signal. This reads like a scene from a sitcom.
It's a classic example of the pressure these guys were under. Dudley is a greenie, brand new, doesn't speak the language well, totally terrified. His senior companion, V. Leikater, comes up with a plan.
The heist plan.
Pretty much. Cotter tells him, okay, we're teaching Sister Kreutzer, I'll do the talking, but when I adjust the knot on my tie, that's the signal. You take over.
Which is honestly a terrible plan for someone who is already hyperventilating.
Terrible. So they're in the lesson, Cotter is talking, he reaches up, adjusts his tie, Dudley sees the signal, and freezes.
Mine goes blank.
Totally blank. Cotter waits a second, keeps talking, and then adjusts the tie again. A little more aggressively this time.
Take the hint, Dudley.
Dudley is just paralyzed. The adrenaline spike is so intense, and then the crash is so hard that Dudley doesn't just stay silent. He actually falls asleep.
No.
Yes. Right there in the middle of the lesson, Cotter has to reach over and shake his leg to wake him up.
And Sister Kreutzer's just sitting there watching this whole meltdown.
She just smiled at him. She knew.
Bless her heart.
But despite the comedy of errors, she does decide to be baptized. And this leads to another one of those unexplainable moments. Right. The baptism was scheduled for an outdoor pool in Rovaniemi in August. Now, August sounds like summer, but you have to remember where we are.
It's still the Arctic.
Exactly. The source says it had been raining for 3 days straight. It was freezing cold. They were genuinely worried about her health.
So they do the only thing they can do.
They pray for the rain to stop. And according to Dudley's account, the rain stopped exactly 1 hour before the ceremony. The clouds broke, the sun came out, she was baptized, and it was a beautiful service as soon as it was over.
The weather turned again.
Yep.
It's these little pockets of reprieve that seem to stick with them. But for me, the real emotional core with Sister Kreutzer isn't the baptism. It's the Christmas Eve story from 1974.
Oh, this is a profound scene.
This is where the history of Finland really crashes into these American kids' lives in a way I don't think they were expecting.
Carrie Barney writes about visiting her cottage on Christmas Eve. Now, Sister Kreutzer lived in poverty, but when they arrived, she had prepared a feast. Carrot casserole, hunter steak, fruit soup, all the traditional Finnish holiday foods.
Barney suspects she sent every penny she had on that meal.
Very likely. And as they're eating, she opens up, she brings out her wedding photos. Her husband was a soldier. He died fighting the Soviet Union in the Winter War.
And for listeners who might not be history buffs, the Winter War was this brutal conflict in 1939 and 40. Finland held off a massive Soviet invasion, but the cost was staggering. It defines that generation.
Absolutely. She had been a widow for decades. The war took her husband, but it didn't take her spirit. After dinner, in this tiny cottage, she puts on an old 78 RPM record of Enrico Caruso.
The Opry singer.
Yes. And she grabs these young American boys who are probably thinking about their families back home, and she teaches them to waltz.
Imagine that contrast.
Yeah.
Outside, it's the pitch-black Arctic night. Inside, you have cracking opera music, the smell of hunter's steak, and a war widow dancing with a teenager.
It's about shared humanity. She was connecting them to her past, to the life she lost. She was bridging the gap. Barney writes that as they left her house that night, loaded down with sweets, they looked up and saw the aurora borealis, red, green, and purple, exploding across the sky.
It ties the landscape and the emotion together perfectly. It's also a reminder that for these missionaries, success wasn't always a conversion. Sometimes it was just alleviating someone's loneliness for an evening.
Precisely. And that connection leaves a mark. Speaking of connections that defy time, we have to revisit the waiting at the door story with Sister Kumpula, because that story didn't end in the 1970s.
This is where we get into what you might call ripple effects, or maybe spiritual coincidences.
Ralph Valentine writes that 40 years later, four decades after his mission, he was reading his scriptures and felt a sudden, powerful prompting. He felt that Sister Kumpula, the woman who prayed for messengers, wanted to be sealed to her husband.
And just to clarify, in their theology, this means a proxy marriage ceremony in a temple so a couple can be together in the afterlife.
Correct. But Valentine had a problem. He didn't know the husband's name. He hadn't thought about the details in years. He went to Ancestry.com, tried to find her records.
And hit a brick wall.
Couldn't find her. And here's where the network comes back into play. He gets a thought. Call Veli Bowden.
His old companion, the guy who stood on the porch with him.
Yep, he calls him up. And it turns out, Bowden was a better archivist. He still had his original missionary journal from 40 years ago. He looks through it, finds Sister Kumpula's first name, which Valentine had forgotten. With that key piece of information, they were able to find the husband's records.
So Valentine and Bowden, now old men themselves, went to the temple together.
Valentine performed the baptism and Bowden performed the sealing. It's a fascinating look at how these relationships echo through time.
There's another story that illustrates this ripple effect even more dramatically. And honestly, the odds on this one are staggering. The story of Daniel Harding and the radio interview.
This one is a study in randomness. Daniel Harding is in Salo. It's the very last night of his two-year mission. It's 9:30 p.m. He should be packing.
Right. Going home.
But he has this nagging urge to talk to one last person.
The classic just one more mentality.
He goes out with a brand new companion, Thomas Little. The streets are empty. The only guy they see is a man with a microphone. Turns out to be a radio presenter, interviews them on the spot about why they're in Finland.
Cool souvenir to end your mission with. But fast forward 25 years.
Harding's son is at BYU in the U.S. He walks into the Gap, the clothing store, to buy a pair of pants, starts talking to a girl working there. They hit it off. They start dating. They get married.
And the reveal.
The girl is the daughter of Thomas Little.
No.
Harding's companion from that last night in Salo.
So the son of the senior companion marries the daughter of the junior companion. And the fathers only met on that one night because Harding wanted to talk to one last person.
The odds are astronomical. And to put a final bow on it, Harding later learned that a listener to that random radio interview actually ended up joining their church. It shows how these small decisions, stopping for one person, buying pants at the Gap, weave together into this massive tapestry.
It's of the butterfly effect in action. We see a similar thing with D. Child's story in Savilena. They get dropped by a family right before Christmas. Total heartbreak.
Right. And on Christmas morning, instead of sulking, they feel an impression to attend the local Lutheran church service, which frankly is not where Mormon missionaries usually hang out.
A bit off brand.
But they go, they sit in the back, and who do they see? The family that dropped them. They wave, they reconnect, the door reopens, and eventually the family is baptized. It reinforces that theme of listening to intuition.
We've talked a lot about the people, but I want to touch on the environment one last time, specifically the reindeer hide. This story from Nolan Money feels like a quest from a fantasy novel.
It does. Money gets a telegram from the mission president. Call the office ASAP. Usually that means you're in trouble. Instead, he gets a mission. The president of the church, Spencer W. Kimball, is visiting Finland. The mission president wants Money to go buy a pure white reindeer hide as a gift.
A pure white hide, not the gray or brown ones.
He had to dig through piles to find the perfect one. He rolls it up, carries it on the train, and eventually every missionary in the mission signs the back of it. It's this tangible artifact of that place and time.
You can't get more finished than a signed white reindeer hide. It really grounds the experience. And speaking of things that ground you, or maybe unground you, the memoirs also mention what they call the gift of tongues.
Right. We talked about how hard the language was, the 15 cases, the complexity, but there were moments where that barrier just dissolved.
Greg Colton, the guy with the freezing apartment, prayed for help. He says suddenly, in a lesson, he could understand the investigator perfectly. It wasn't that he learned the vocabulary instantly. It was like a spiritual bypass of the language center.
Reed Finley has a similar story. He's with a Swedish companion. Finley doesn't speak Swedish. His companion is talking to a father. And suddenly, Finley understands the entire conversation as if it were English.
From a psychological perspective, you could look at these as flow states induced by high pressure and intense focus.
Or from their spiritual perspective, it's divine aid. But either way, these moments act as anchors. When everything is dark and confusing, these flashes of clarity provide the hope they need to keep going.
It creates this rhythm of struggle and breakthrough, darkness and light, which, as Bruce Sheldy pointed out, is literally the rhythm of Finland.
Sheldy has a beautiful reflection on this. He talks about the Finnish tradition of visiting cemeteries on Christmas Eve to light candles on the graves, a sea of candles against the snow. He says Finns turn darkness into a celebration of light.
He contrasts arriving in total darkness in December with leaving in June during the midnight sun, where the sun never sets.
It's the ultimate metaphor for their experience. They arrive in a place that feels cold and foreign darkness. And through these relationships, the Moes, the Sister Kreutzers, the random radio hosts, they find light.
Scott Anderson sums this up really well. He doesn't sugarcoat the difficulty. He says, people yelled, cursed, swore at us. We were chased by a dog, accused of being FBI agents.
Which, to be fair, two young American men in dark suits walking around 1970s Finland, I can see why the locals might jump to the FBI conclusion.
Totally. It looks suspicious. But Anderson concludes that despite the slammed doors and the frozen toes, the experience deepened roots.
And that's the synthesis here. This deep dive isn't just about conversion numbers. It's about the profound human need for connection. Whether it's a widow needing to teach someone to waltz, or two old friends reuniting after 20 years because some kids waited at a door.
It's about showing up, even when it's cold, even if they don't speak the language.
Exactly. Showing up is 90% of the miracle.
So here's a final thought for you to chew on. Think back to that tie signal with Daryl Dudley. The young missionary, terrified, waiting for his companion to adjust his knot so he could recite a memorized script. He was so focused on the mechanics, on the plan, that he froze and missed the moment entirely.
He was too worried about the performance to actually connect.
How often do we do that? How often do we miss the miraculous, the intuition, the person right in front of us, because we're too busy worrying about what we're supposed to say next? Maybe the magic isn't in the perfect script. Maybe it's just in the willingness to knock on the door and wait a few minutes longer than usual.
Beautifully put.
Thanks for diving in with us. We'll catch you on the next one.